Welcome, Susie. I'd
Thank
like to
you,
start
Linda.
by asking you why it's important to seek the views and wishes of children and young people who've experienced or are experiencing trauma like family violence.
I think there's really a couple of imperatives to do that. On the individual level, I think unless we understand the experience of the child, we can't think about their views and wishes. And if we're working in a person-centred way, then we really have to think about the views and wishes of children. They are part of the service system. They are entitled to have a service provided, and they're entitled to have their voice heard. And I think, you know, if we think about the UN rights of the child, for instance, if we think about certainly now the imperatives of the MARAM framework and the information sharing schemes, that kind of gives us the systems imperative to think about that. And I think because the views and wishes of children occur in the context of their experience, it's really about understanding what children have gone through, understanding what's happening in their family, and then we're best placed, having built a relationship with a child, to think about what their views and wishes are. And for some children, it's the first time that an adult has actually sought to think about what the child might want or what the child believes is going to be appropriate for them. And we want empowered children to grow up to be empowered adults. So I think there's no reason not to do it. You know, if we're going to provide a full service for a parent as well, then we have to think about the views and wishes of their children and the experiences of their children.
What can seeking the views and wishes of children or young people tell a practitioner about the well-being of a child, Susie?
Lots and lots, certainly more than if we're not seeking their views and wishes. And I think, again, it's about the relationship that we build with a child. And from that comes our understanding of their well-being, comes an understanding of why they hold the views and wishes that they do. And I think it's really important that we're transparent with children, as we should be with adults, that seeking their views and wishes is not a guarantee that we can provide those, but that we can take them into account when we're thinking about how do we provide a service for a parent and child? How do we provide a service for a young person? And empower that young person to participate in the decision-making around what happens for them. And I think, you know, I remember a young person I worked with, he was 10, and he spoke about wanting to go into out-of-home care, wanting child protection to remove him. Now, had I not understood what was happening for him in his family, had I not understood the experiences he'd had from his perspective, I'd have thought that the reason he wanted that was something very different to what it was. His reason was actually because he didn't want to be a burden to his mother, and he knew his mother was really busy with his very young siblings. And because we understood what was happening for him, what his experiences had been, we not only understood what his wish was, but the context of that wish and how we could work with him so that he didn't want to leave his mother and family, but he thought that would be the most helpful thing. And we were able to work with him and help him to understand that actually that was not the most helpful thing for him or for his family. But unless we had thought about what had happened for him, we wouldn't have understood what his views were, and nor would he have felt safe enough to tell us what his views were and his wishes were.
How should practitioners seek the views and wishes of children or young people who have experienced a trauma like family violence?
Again, I think it's part of building that relationship with a child and a young person, and allowing that child or young person to see that you're a safe person who can hold not only their views and wishes, but their concerns and their stories about what's happened for them. And I think if we build that level of trust and we build that relationship and we allow children to tell their stories, part of telling their stories is actually telling what their views and wishes are. I think sometimes there are children who are pre-verbal or older children who are non-verbal because of trauma. And I think we still can seek their views and wishes. We can still seek to understand their experience. And I think Wendy Bunston, the fabulous Wendy Bunston, when she talks about how we think about infants and how do we bring infants into the room, or children who are not physically in the room, into the room. So how do we wonder about what their experience has been? How do we wonder about what it might be that they would like to be different? And I think that not only gives us a sense of what might be happening for a child or what a child might want, but we can model for the parent that just because children are pre-verbal or very, very little infants, it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing the world around them, that they're not experiencing the relationships around them, and that they don't have feelings about what's happening around them. And we can support parents to actually try and understand how it is that they can have conversations with their child, even their pre-verbal child, and think about what might be better changed, what might be different for them if we were to think about it from their perspective.
Would practitioner approaches change, Susie, if they were working with children from cold communities or with working with Aboriginal children or children with a disability?
I think their approaches necessarily wouldn't change, but I think if we understand the context of, for instance, Aboriginal children and the context of their family and the impacts of colonisation that flow down through all the generations since colonisation and the impacts that trauma has on very young children, and that as non-Aboriginal people, we're not best placed to either provide a response for that child or to provide information that can support us to provide a response. Some Aboriginal families would choose to not be supported in an Aboriginal organisation for a range of reasons, and that's absolutely their right. But I think it's really important that we have connections with Aboriginal people in health, in housing, in family violence, so that we can do secondary consults, so that we can think about how can I best, if somebody doesn't choose to be referred to an Aboriginal specific organisation, which again we should always be offering, how can we support as a non-Aboriginal person, for instance, how can I provide the best response to this child for whom their culture is their core being? And if even for Aboriginal children who don't know their mob, who don't know their country, we can provide a tailored response to them and to their family that is centred within culture. And the same for families who have come from countries where they've been impacted by war, again, where there's been trauma that's moved through the family for generations. And again, we should be consulting with people from that culture, and again, not identifying our clients if they choose not to be supported by a specific cultural organisation, but we can certainly be informed about how we can provide the best response and what things we need to be aware of in a cultural context to provide that.
Susie, can you provide some examples of practitioners seeking the views and wishes of children and young people and the advantages of different approaches to this?
I think, you know, there's lots of examples. If I think about people who work in youth refuges, for instance, are really, really good at having conversations with young people about not a specific let's sit down and talk about your views and wishes, but seeking their views about what do you reckon we should have for dinner? What do you reckon, you know, we should watch on TV? What do you reckon? And those little choices and little opportunities for young people who potentially have had very little experience of their own decision making and having their own agency and their own power. They're the things that build to young people being able to say, actually, I don't want to continue in education. I want to move into straight into employment now, or I want to make a decision about with whom I live, or I want to make a decision about where I live, where I move to. So I think it's from the little decisions and the little views and wishes that we seek that young people are empowered to tell us about their big wishes and their big dreams and goals. And I think by providing a safe space for people to talk about that and providing, as we try and do for adult clients, you know, we try and provide a safe space that is not judgmental, that is walking beside rather than holding power over. And I think young people and children and infants are entitled to that as much as adults are. And for younger children, I think it's, you know, it's about smaller things. With our own children, for instance, we don't wait till they're 15 or 16 and say, now we want you to tell us what you want, and now we want you to make really good decisions. You know, we start when they're pre-verbal. Show me which shirt you want to wear. We hold up a banana or an apple. Which piece of fruit would you like? And that's what builds in children and young people that capacity to make choices and to understand choices and to also feel safe to express, I do like this and I don't like that, and I want to go that way, not that way. And we can't always provide that, like we can't for parents and for adults, but we can always hear what it is that they would like. And it's very empowering, and that, you know, what we want is children who grow to be young people who are empowered to make choices and make decisions and to feel that they can do that and hold their own power in their lives.
What then are the necessary skills for practitioners when working with children and young people, and how do these skills also extend to working with protective parents or carers?
So I think, for me, I think it's not so much about specific skills. I think people can learn skills. I think it's about the underlying beliefs that you have about children's place in the family and in society, about children's right to receive a service from service providers. I think it's about having an understanding of a range of frameworks. So understanding, for instance, about culture, about how important culture is for families, having an understanding of attachment theory and what might be happening in relationships when you're presented with a parent and an infant. How do you understand that relationship based on things other than verbal cues and conversations between parent and child? How do you understand the behaviour of the infant and the behaviour of the toddler and the behaviour of the parent? I think having an understanding of trauma theory and trauma-informed practice, so that we understand when we're seeing behaviours, whether it be from children or whether it be from adults who were children who experienced trauma, we can understand what sits behind that behaviour, and we can understand how to work with that behaviour, how to work with that client. If we have an understanding, for instance, of neurobiology, of what happens for a fetus in utero when a woman is exposed to ongoing fear, what happens to the cortisol that circulates through the placental membrane and into the infant. You know, I think when we understand all of those frameworks and theories, best interest principles, you know, then we've got a kit bag of things that we can use to build our skills. I think it's also by watching other practitioners, by watching our peers and our colleagues and the way that they deal with situations that arise. And I think there's always capacity to keep learning. You know, I've been in my role a number of years, but there's still things all the time that I pick up from people around me. People, things that I pick up from clients, observing clients, things that, that children tell us about. And I think if we are open to hearing the voice of children and we're open to hearing their experiences and we have the capacity to sit and hold that, you know, I think then we're best placed to provide a response. And I think we also have to be aware of how much parents of children are watching us. So it's really important that we can model for parents who perhaps themselves had parents who had a very poor parenting template. You know, we can model for parents that it's okay to have difficult conversations with children. We want children to know that there's nothing too terrible, that they can't talk about it with a safe person. And, you know, obviously safety has to be the prime thing that sits in front of everything else, the safety for children and the safety for parents. But we want children to be able to talk to us. Children tell us, you know, I've facilitated groups with children for many years, and children tell us all the time that they don't want to burden their parents by telling them about their troubles and their worries. And so sometimes we're the people who sit in that place to hear those things from children. It's a very privileged place. But I think, you know, we can model for our colleagues and we can model for parents that's okay. We can hear those things and we can hold those things, and that there's going to be a solution. Might not be the fix-all, cure-all solution that we would love, but there's always things that we can do to assist and to support and to help children to understand that they are important and their views are important and their wishes are important and they have the right to have their voice heard.
Susie, can you comment on how to respond or manage situations where children and young people, when they express their views and wishes, that where a service provider, a practitioner can't respond affirming their choice or their preferences? It might be about information sharing, it might be about where they want to live, it might be about the response that they would like. How should practitioners, or how could practitioners, manage that?
Again, I think transparency is really important. You know, with our adult clients at the start of service, when adults are parents, we always talk to them about the limits of our confidentiality, that we will hold your information, but the limits of the confidentiality are, you know, for people who aren't parenting, you know, commission of a serious crime, if we feel somebody's life is at risk. And we do the same for children. You know, we do the same in our children's groups. We always start by talking about the limits of our confidentiality, that we won't be discussing individual things that they tell us unless we're concerned for their safety and for other people's safety, in which case we'll always try and have a conversation with them, but that we'll need to talk to other adults about it. And I think we need to be saying to children, you know, I really want to hear what's important for you. I really want to hear the outcome that's important for you. And very often for children within family violence, it's around seeing their parent who's chosen violence, very often the father or somebody in that, you know, a parent's partner. And very often children want to see that person, even though that person is scary and makes them feel uncomfortable. So it's about having a conversation with children that we understand their feelings. We understand that they still love this person. We understand that they still care about this person and that it's not their fault, but right now it's not safe for the child. And I think if we're honest and we don't try to hide things from children, and again, I think modelling that it's okay for children to love their parent who's chosen violence, but that there are limits around what we can do to facilitate that relationship. I remember being in a group with a young boy who drew a very graphic picture, I can't remember the activity, but a big red heart, and he drew a black dagger coming into the heart and blood dripping from that. And I said to him something about, you know, wow, that's a really powerful picture. Would you like to tell me something about it? And he said, I love my dad and I want to stab him in the heart until he's dead. And I think, you know, understanding that ambivalence and that strength of feeling that children hold, unless we understand that, how do we support them to make sense of that? It's difficult for adults to hold ambivalence like that. How do we support children to make a sense of that? And it's, again, by building that relationship, by helping children see that we can hold what it is they have to tell us and that we can support them through that, which doesn't mean providing always everything that they wish for or hope for. But if we can't do that, explaining to them that their wishes and views are still really important and we want to understand them, we just can't always provide them. Does that answer?
Yeah, thanks, Susie. And just finally, what additional supports would you recommend for practitioners or organisations wanting to improve their child and young person-led practice?
Well, I think the Statewide Children's Resource Program is a good place to start. So there's somebody in this position across all of Victoria. I sit in the inner and outer eastern, but every part of Victoria is covered. So we can provide secondary consults and training and resources. But I think there's a range of resources out there. There's a range of training out there for people. I think it's sometimes about having conversations where, you know, where you've had something tricky that's been presented. I think it's about really good supervision, having the capacity to reflect on what maybe didn't go so well, what did go well. I think it's about the capacity to think about how we are when we sit with clients. I think it's about, I know the Australian Childhood Foundation, for instance, have just released a series of international speakers who are fantastic, who are amazing contributors to research and to information about children and trauma. And they're really, really affordable for services at the moment as webinars. And there are all sorts of resources on, for instance, Australian Childhood Foundation's website, but there's a range. There are resources on the Centre for Excellence website. There are webinars coming up through the Centre for Excellence all the time. And I think it's about, certainly since I started, people didn't really attend children's training because children weren't seen as the core business of family violence services and homelessness services. But I think that's really changed now. And I think the introduction of the reforms after the Royal Commission into Family Violence have made a really big difference to that. So there's lots of things around, and I'm always happy for people to ring me and ask me what might be available.
Thanks, Susie. I'd like to really thank you for sharing those comments today. I think they're really applicable across the child and family services workforce and other allied workforces like the homelessness sector and drug and alcohol and specialist family violence sector. It's always really good working with you and your team at the Statewide Children's Resource Program. For additional information for people who've watched this discussion today, you can always look on the Centre's website. We'll try and list additional resources that Susie's referred to in the discussion today. And of course, there's the Statewide Children's Resource Program that you can also get the details from our website about too. So thanks for the discussion, Susie.
Thanks, Annabelle. It's a pleasure.